This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour, Iran reiterates that Israel is an apartheid regime, urging Western states to defend Palestinians' rights instead of denying realities on the regime's crimes. Israeli forces kill another Palestinian youth during an incursion on a holy site near the city of Nablus, near the occupied West Bank. Saudi Arabia sentences a woman to 34 years in prison over her Twitter activities, marking a new milestone in the kingdom's crackdown on social media users. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman has strongly criticized the Western governments for denying the realities that prove Israel is an apartheid regime. Nasser Kanani said official international documents and reports by human rights organizations proved that Israel is an apartheid regime. He added that Israel has been committing genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Kanani urged the Western states to defend the human rights of Palestinians instead of denying the existing realities on Israel's crimes. His remarks came after Germany and Israel slammed Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's remarks on the occupying regime's crimes against Palestinians. During a recent visit to Germany, Abbas accused Israel of committing a Holocaust against the Palestinian people. German Chancellor called Abbas's remarks outrageous, with Israeli Prime Minister describing them as a monstrous lie. Iran's foreign minister says the 2015 nuclear deal can be revived if Tehran's red lines are respected. Hossein Amir Abdollahian also said that Iran will take the next step once it is sure about the full economic benefits of the agreement. He added, Tehran has delivered its opinion on a proposal to the other parties, including the United States, through the EU coordinator. The top diplomat pointed out that Iran is awaiting response, which will determine with the timing of a ministerial-level meeting to revive the accord. The US sent the deal into limbo after unilaterally pulling out of it in 2018 and reimposing sanctions on Iran. Remaining signatories have held several talks of rounds in Vienna since April last year. Earlier this month, the EU proposed what it called the final draft to revive the landmark agreement. Iran has submitted its own assessment of the proposal, which the US is currently studying. A year has passed since the United States pulled its troops out of Afghanistan. The chaotic withdrawal is seen as an utter humiliation for Washington after two decades of military presence in the war-torn country. Yusuf Jalali reports from Tehran.
A year ago, the United States marked a chaotic end to 20 years of war in Afghanistan, following a hurried pullout of troops that saw the Taliban reclaiming power in the country. Here in Tehran, Iranian officials and political analysts sat together to discuss different aspects of the incident. They regard Washington's exit as an escape from the Afghan quagmire after it failed to achieve its geostrategic objectives there.
Today, the significance of Afghanistan has not diminished in the eyes of the Americans. They didn't leave the country to let China, Russia, and Iran invest in it. The U.S. had to leave because it totally failed there. But it will continue to make the best of its efforts to destabilize Afghanistan.
Last year, in late August, the U.S. evacuated thousands of troops from Afghanistan in just a few days, following President Joe Biden's order to exit fully by August 30, 2021. The withdrawal marked the end of two decades of war in Afghanistan, which sought to bring peace to the country, but left a trail of chaos and mayhem.
The United States not only did not fight terrorism during its two decades of presence in Afghanistan, but had a role in many acts of terrorism to legitimize and prolong its presence there.
1 year after the U.S. pullout, Afghanistan is still bogged down in turmoil. The country has been the scene of recurrent terrorist attacks, some of which have been claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. Iran says the U.S. has resorted to Daesh to wage a proxy war in Afghanistan to make up for its losses.
The U.S. continues to back terrorists such as Daesh to destabilize Afghanistan. Aside from Daesh, it has been hosting some 7,000 Afghan military forces from the previous Afghan army to train them. What's the goal of such military trainings?
Since the Taliban takeover, Iran has been calling for an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan as the ultimate way out of the persisting instability in the war-torn country.
Experts here describe the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan a lasting shame for America and the worst fiasco after its loss in the 1950s Vietnam War. They say the chaotic exit is also a lesson for the region that wherever Washington has set foot, it has left nothing but mess and destruction for the hosting nations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A bomb blast in Afghanistan's capital has claimed the lives of at least 20 people. The explosion took place in a mosque in northern Kabul, where worshippers were holding evening prayers. Over 40 people also have been wounded. A 7-year-old child is among the injured. Investigation into the incident is underway. No group has claimed responsibility as of yet. Supporters of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan have taken to the streets in Islamabad to protest against the government and its economic measures. Lawmakers from Pakistan's Tehreek-e-Insaf party were also among the protesters. Nasir Kazmi reports from Islamabad.
Supporters of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan and lawmakers from the Tehreek-e-Insaf party held a rally in the capital Islamabad against what they called government's US-backed policies. Since being removed from power through a no-confidence vote in April, Imran Khan has heaped pressure on the country's fragile new coalition government by staging mass rallies demanding fresh elections. Holding responsible Pakistan's coalition government for rising inflation and unrest, the protesters condemned what they called government crackdown on media supporting the former PM's anti-US narrative.
Banning the channel has different modes. Mode number one, their anchors are being harassed to an extent that they have to leave the motherland. Secondly, registration of cases of sedition against those who speak for the freedom of expression and press.
Actually, the important government is propagating the views and the narrative of Americans in our states. That's why once Shehbaz Sharif said that we are the beggars and beggars are not choosers. Excuse me, we are not beggars. We are independent state.
Some analysts believe Imran Khan has managed to pressurize the government with his anti-US narrative. However, it is estimated that the current political setup will complete its tenure and general elections would be held at a scheduled time.
Imran Khan wants immediate elections as his popularity graph went all-time high in his political career. But if you look into the situation, I think the present government is serious in completing its tenure and trying to gain the public trust.
The government says Imran Khan and his allies want to destabilize Pakistan by creating a chaotic situation, adding it would complete its constitutional term and elections would be held next year. Pakistanis have now a divided view on friendship with the U.S., with some terming it mandatory for the national interest and others calling it an obstacle to the national sovereignty. Whenever the general elections are held, U.S. ties will be a key issue for a political party that will be in power. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Israeli forces have killed another Palestinian youth. This happened during an attack by the regime's forces on the outskirts of the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. The 18-year-old Wasim Nasser Abu Khalifa succumbed to injuries he sustained after being hit by Israeli gunfire at Joseph's Tomb, east of Nablus. This came after Palestinian resistance fighters exchanged fire with Israeli forces during an incursion on the holy site. At least 31 Palestinians were wounded in the ensuing clashes. According to Palestinian media, 3 Palestinians injured by the Israeli live fire are in critical condition. A Saudi court has sentenced a woman to 34 years in prison over her Twitter activities, marking the longest jail term ever given to a rights activist. The woman, identified as Salma al-Shahab, has been charged with assisting dissidents who seek to disrupt public order and destabilize civil and national security. She has also been banned from traveling abroad for 34 years. Shahab had frequently tweeted about women's rights in the kingdom. The mother of two children, Shahab is a PhD candidate at Britain's University of Leeds. She was detained in January 2021 when she was visiting home for a vacation. The London-based rights group Al-Ghist has denounced the court ruling, saying it makes a mockery of Saudi Arabia's claims to reform for women and of the legal system. The sentence comes amid a harsh crackdown on rights activists, many of whom have been slapped with jail sentences and travel bans. Shahab's sentence can be appealed within 30 days at the Kingdom's Supreme Court. Up next is the new episode of Hashtag Trending, how social media reacted to a Saudi-sponsored humanitarian crisis that has plagued Yemen since 2015.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, your host Ali Reza. In March of 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the United Arab Emirates, launched a catastrophic war on Yemen. The war has destroyed the country and killed thousands of people there. Yemen was already the poorest country before the war started. The aggression, which is supported by the United States and other Western countries, has plunged the country into a crisis that would take decades to remedy. Now, social media users have taken to Twitter to highlight the plight of the Yemeni people and the catastrophic humanitarian situation there. Let's take a look at our first batch of tweets. The first one comes from Erlene Gaynell. Yemen equals no food, no water, and no hope. Anas Mansour has our next tweet. In Yemen, 2.4 million children under the age of 5 suffer from acute malnutrition, of which 500,000 classified starvation-like conditions. Another tweet by the Echo of Humanity. A staggering 23 million people in Yemen need humanitarian assistance this year. Funding remains the biggest challenge. Mike Jonathan said, the siege kills the people of Yemen. The objective of the war was to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of former Yemeni President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi and crush Ansarullah. The coalition failed to achieve its goal and instead turned Yemen into a crippled nation. Yemen Incognito shared a video with the caption that reads, millions of Yemenis are facing water scarcity. The water crisis exacerbates their difficulties in what has been described by the UN as the world's worst humanitarian crisis produced by the Saudi-UAE-led war in Yemen. All right, moving on to our next tweet by Jung Agedini Williams. Millions of people in Yemen are struggling to access basic needs, water, food, shelter, healthcare. Cecile Schmitter has our next tweet. The whole world has turned its back on Yemen and turned a blind eye to the war crimes of the Saudi-US coalition. Shame on this humanity in the year 2022. In April, a UN-brokered truce between the coalition and Ansarullah came into effect. The truce has since been extended twice, but many believe that the UN has failed to punish Saudi Arabia and its Western allies. Moving on to our final batch of comments, the next one comes from Najib bin Ghalib. All people of Yemen hold America responsible for all the genocide and blockade crimes being committed against them for over 7 years now. Yemenis know that Saudi and UAE are but U.S. proxies following instructions. Salem S. tweeted, MBS and MBZ, Mohammed bin Salman and Mohammed bin Zayed, are the regional agents for USA and Zionism to kill Yemenis and create the worst world crisis ever seen over decades. What else does the global community need to be convinced about taking the decision to stop this aggression against Yemen? Ayman has our next tweet. I call on the United Nations and the international community to assume their responsibilities in opening Yemeni ports to fuel, food and medicine ships and opening Sana'a Airport. And our final comment comes from Ian Bice. This is the result of imperialism and supremacism. The evil in the world needs to be stopped. Well, that's a wrap for another edition of Hashtag Trending. Take care and bye-bye.
UK inflation has also risen to another 40-year high as spiraling food and energy prices continue to intensify a historic squeeze on households, otherwise known as the cost of living crisis. Saeed Pourreza asked Londoners how they're coping with soaring prices amid a record pay slump.
The sizzling temperatures have cooled off in the UK, but the inflation rate is only heating up. Prices are going up everywhere, as inflation, this time driven by food price hikes, jumps to its highest level since 1982, coming in at more than 10%. Millions of families across Britain are now trying to make their money stretch, but it's getting harder by the day.
My weekly, my monthly, everything's shop is increasing. I'm shopping right now whilst I'm at work to just save time. Because not only is your time money, but we don't really have much of that thing called money.
I am having to budget myself, limit myself, to try and ensure that my wage lasts the whole month, considering I'm having to pay for petrol, bills, rent. It does all add up.
It's harder for me to afford things because, you know, I don't have the steady income like most people do in London.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect inflation storm caused by a number of factors. Brexit and the delays and disruptions it has caused to the supply chain, the pandemic, and the ongoing Western-backed war in Ukraine.
The UK economy reopened suddenly after COVID, creating bottlenecks at ports compounded by post-Brexit red tape, followed by astronomical energy prices resulting from a decision to wean the UK from Russian energy. Inside the UK, that has translated into higher transport and packaging costs, soaring energy and food prices. That means bills getting more and more expensive in supermarkets, restaurants, and gas stations, feeding the demand for higher pay, which adds further to business costs, which turns into even higher prices. And it is that demand for wage increases that's seen multiple public sector strikes in recent weeks. It's a worsening mess that some economists say is in large part the UK government's own doing.
The answer is the war in Ukraine. And you will say, well, is the war in Ukraine going to come to an end? And the answer is no, not if the UK government can help it. You see, Western foreign policy is involved in another debacle.
All this at a time when the UK awaits a new prime minister. Whoever they may be, they have their job cut out for them. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thanks for joining us.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Researchers find that the U.S. had become an outlier among other rich countries in mortality rates long before the pandemic, and that Americans are dying younger than their peers abroad. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Lynn Paramore Ryder. This article is published under the heading, United States of Death? Study shows worrying mortality rates of broken health system. This is the first part of the story. When it comes to health in the United States, a fundamental prerequisite to a fulfilling life, the U.S. isn't delivering and hasn't been for a long time. Researchers now find that the big picture of health failings is even graver than we already knew. Piles of studies have called attention to the fact that in the country ranking number one in healthcare spending per capita, people are living shorter lives, feeling more depressed, and are more likely to skip treatment due to cost than in many developed nations. In a performance ranking of 11 high-income countries compiled by the Commonwealth Fund in 2021, the American healthcare system came in dead last with the worst outcomes of any of the nations studied. The only wealth is life, wrote the 19th century critic John Ruskin. Recent research indicates that America may be rich in dollars, but getting poorer in ways that matter most. In a stunning new report, Missing Americans, Early Death in the United States, between 1933 to 2021, Boston University Professor of Global Health and Epidemiology Jacob Bohr and colleagues pored over data from the CDC and a global mortality database. During the period investigated, they compared U.S. mortality rates with those of Canada, Japan, and 16 Western European countries. How many American lives would have been saved each year? Asked the researchers. If U.S. mortality rates had matched those of other wealthy nations, a staggering number is the answer. According to researchers, the U.S. started out of the gate in 1933 as a global health frontrunner, showing a significant advantage in mortality rates over the peer countries studied. But starting in 1970s, something went awry. Overall, Americans began to die at higher rates than their peers, a trend that grew steadily and picked up steam in the 2000s. By the year 2019, the number of annual excess deaths had reached a stunning 656,353. Bohr and his colleagues refer to these people who died as missing Americans, the friends, family members, and colleagues who would still be with them if only modern U.S. healthcare and social policy lived up to their early promise. Consider the figure of 656,353 missing Americans is the number of excess deaths just in the year 2019 alone. In a single year, Americans lost needlessly more than the population of Detroit, Las Vegas, or Baltimore, and this was before the pandemic. In 2021, the number of missing Americans swelled to 1,092,293. A whole lot more than you could put on milk cartons, more than Atlanta and Miami combined. Even worse, half of them were under age 65. Bohr and his fellow researchers found that, on average, not only were there more Americans dying relative to their peers abroad, the deaths were becoming younger. These are human beings who didn't have to live with their peer Americans. People who had children, elders, and neighbors to look after. Contributions to make, love and laughter to share. The researchers found a haunting way to help them envision the profound depth of the tragedy. Based on the age at which Americans succumbed and the number of years they could have been expected to live, had they been born in Finland, Spain, Japan, or other countries' studies, Bohr and colleagues tabulate that in a single year. 2021, America sustained 25 million years of life lost. Again, the figure of 25 million years of life lost is only for the year 2021. In 2022, as even more people die at 60 instead of 80, millions more future years of life will never be lived. The coronavirus is supposed to prey most viciously on the elderly. But in America, people still in their working years have been dropping away at higher rates during the pandemic than in peer nations, as they have been for years. Unsurprisingly, Black and Native Americans make up a disproportionate share of those vanished years and lives. Why, in a country with so much to spend and so much spent on medical care, are so many lives being cut short? How did Americans start out so well and end up so badly? Bohr notes that the American mortality advantage in the late 1930s and 1940s was impacted by the high death rates in peer countries due to the Second World War, and that the disadvantage of much of Europe and Japan likely continued for about a decade after the war because of the widespread devastation. But he also points to several other factors that probably helped Americans live longer into the 1950s, such as the relative strength of organized labor and consequent rising wages, plus the large public investments that helped boost the middle class, like the GI Bill and the promotion of high-income ownership, with the caveat that these advantages were primarily available to white Americans. Bohr observed that the later period of American mortality advantage was likely bolstered by Johnson's War on Poverty and the marked expansion of the safety net by Medicare and Medicaid, as well as the racial integration of hospitals in 1963, and environmental regulation which made water and air healthier. All of which, these programs and policies took some of the gains that occurred in 1950s and expanded them so that it wasn't just people with middle-class incomes and white people who had access to the detriments of a healthy, long life, he explains. Yet even during the period of relative mortality advantages, America's inequality and structural racism likely held back the country's longevity record from being as good as it could have been. Older populations in the U.S. have tended to have better mortality outcomes relative to peer countries than younger groups. Bohr cites the fact that Americans have to reach the age of 65 before benefits like universal healthcare kick in as negatively impacting younger people's life expectancy. This age-related trend shifted somewhat from 1980 to 2000. But the researchers found that in the 2000s, the age-related mortality picture is clear. The story of the U.S. disadvantage is primarily about people under 65 dying at higher rates than in peer countries. The year when America's overall mortality numbers diverged from other wealthy nations is 1980, according to the researchers' findings. If the name Ronald Reagan comes to mind, you're not alone. Bohr notes that a Twitter discussion of the team's work has homed in on this association. However, he emphasizes that the story is more complicated than one man's presidency and its attendant policy changes, citing multiple factors such as the rise in opioid-related deaths in 2000s, as well as increasing deaths due to obesity, diabetes, and metabolic syndrome. Gun violence has also increased America's relative death toll.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you,
Because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. I'm your host, Zainab Askari. Well, we have heard about the events of Karbala and women who had played important role in it. But there's a question that whether women before the moment of Karbala, were there women during the Karbala, we know that, but were there women post-Karbala and what was their role? We got to talk about all that in our studio with Siddiqa. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me today. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Siddiqa. Thank you so much for accepting the invitation. A very warm welcome.
Thank you.
Well, dear listeners, Siddiqa is a student of Islamic jurisprudence in the House of Islam of Qom, and she's a researcher about the women issues. Well, Siddiqa, since you study a lot, do extensive research on the issues of women today, since we are going in the holy month of Muharram and Safar, so I would want to know from you. We know that Karbala was a moment in itself, or sometimes it's even said in many quotes that Hussein was not a particular person. It's the name of a moment. So in this moment of Karbala, who supported Imam Hussein alayhi salam? I mean to say, in terms of women, we know he had a lot of companions. We know he had males, females supporting him. But I would want to know from you, before we get into the discussion, who were the women supporting Imam Hussein al-Islam prior to Karbala?
Yes, so when we are looking at the whole movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we see that we had women who supported him when he was on his way to Karbala. So there's a group of women who supported the movement before the actual event, that actual battle happened.
Yeah.
And then you have a group of women who supported him in Karbala.
Yeah.
Who continued his message post-Karbala. Yeah. And after Karbala had finished, you had a group of women who rose to continue the movement and fight against Yazid in order to bring down that dynasty, because this whole movement of Imam Hussein had woken up those dead spirits.
Yeah.
That had died because of years and years of Islamic ignorance. People had left the religion.
Yeah.
Religion was on the tongues, like Imam Hussein alayhi salam was very rightly said. Religion is on the tongue of the people. When things get hard, they run away. Yeah. And this is what had happened. It had come on the tongues only.
Yeah.
So yes, there were a group of women who supported Imam Hussein alayhi salam prior to that actual battle.
Okay.
And they were supportive in the whole movement.
Mm-hmm.
I have a list of three women. There would be more, but I've only narrowed it down to three. The first of them is the one who supported his ambassador. What happened was, the people of Kufa invited Imam Hussein alayhi salam to come and guide them, right? So they wrote, we have historical narrations that say 18,000 letters came to Imam Hussein, and some of them were signed with multiple signatures. So you can, between 18 to 21,000, we know that there are these amount of letters who come, okay, which come to Imam Hussein to guide the people of Kufa. And some of them wrote that if you do not guide us, we are going to go and complain to your grandfather on the day of judgment.
Yeah.
So Imam Hussein sets off. Now Imam Hussein is being taken out of Medina. His life is in danger in Medina.
Yeah.
He heads towards Makkah, then towards Kufa.
Yeah.
Before going towards Kufa, he sends his ambassador, Muslim ibn Aqil, who was also his cousin.
Yeah.
Muslim ibn Aqil goes to Kufa. He's welcomed by a lot of people. Then all of them leave him. Interestingly, Ibn Ziyad enters Kufa with the fear of Ibn Ziyad. These same people who invite Imam Hussein leave his ambassador and run away.
All right. So
Muslim ibn Aqil,
have a dual character people
over
here.
Very dual character. Very hypocritical.
Oh.
They leave him. They leave Muslim ibn Aqil. He's alone. He's moving between the streets. He doesn't have any family. His companions are imprisoned. Hani ibn Urwa was imprisoned and then later killed.
Okay.
Who was one of the supporters of Musab ibn Aqil in that time. There was a lady by the name of Tawa'e.
Okay.
She sees Muslim at her doorstep and she asks him, who are you? And he's like, can you give me some water? So she gives him some water and then he sits over there. He doesn't have any other place to go. She tells him, go home. He's like, I don't have a place to go. She's like, I think you're Muslim. He's like, yes. Tawa'e was one of the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt. She gives him security in her house.
Okay.
Unfortunately, her son is the one who leaks Muslim ibn Aqil's position in her house, and Ibn Ziyad's army comes to kill him.
All right.
But the fact that she supported Imam Hussein by giving security to one of his ambassadors means indirectly she supported his movement.
Exactly.
That's one. Then we have Daylam. Daylam played a very important role. She is the model of how a wife should be.
Okay.
Daylam was the wife of Zuhair ibn Qain. Zuhair ibn Qain was traveling with his wife. Imam Hussein has left Mecca, he's going towards Kufa. Uh-huh. On the way, the two caravans meet each other. Zuhair ibn Qain is trying to run away from Imam Hussein. Zuhair ibn Qain was traveling separately with Daylam, his wife. Imam Hussein is traveling separately, he's going towards Kufa. On the way, the paths meet. Imam Hussein calls Zuhair. He wants to invite Zuhair to his movement.
Mm-hmm.
But Zuhair doesn't want to go.
All right.
So Imam Hussein sends his messenger.
Is he scared?
He's not scared. He just doesn't want to interfere in this matter.
All right. So now, what was the role of this lady? I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady. We're talking about the role of women in Karbala prior to the event of Karbala itself. So yes, Siddiqa, you were saying the role of second lady.
Daylam, yes. So Imam Hussein sends a messenger to Zuhair.
Okay.
Zuhair doesn't want to go. Daylam tells him, she looks at him and she says, the son of the Prophet is calling and you are still thinking about it? Get up and go. So he listens to his wife. He goes to meet Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein invites him to his movement, tells him a few things. Zuhair ibn Qain agrees. He's like, yes, I believe in your movement now. He goes to his wife and he tells her, look, I'm going to join Imam Hussein.
All right.
You don't feel any trouble after this. So Daylam played a very important role by
convincing
her husband to join the movement of Imam Hussein. She was not present in Karbala, but what she did was that after the event of Karbala had happened, and she was following this event very closely.
So here we can say that women who themselves cannot directly participate in the jihad, but at the same time can play a very, very,
very
important role. Convincing their husbands, convincing their sons, providing any kind of support like we saw before.
Yes. And so Daylam later sends her servant to Karbala to cover the body of Zuhair.
Yeah.
And the servant goes and sees the body of Imam Hussein lying over there. So he thinks to himself, he says, how can I shroud the body of my master when the son of the Prophet is unshrouded?
Mm-hmm.
So he goes and shrouds the body of Imam Hussein first. So this is the role of Daylam. Then
right.
We have a third woman, Maria. Maria, who's the daughter of Munqadh Abdiyeh. She was based in Kufa, I believe. It was Kufa or Basra.
Okay.
But her house was the place where she used to invite the women.
Yeah.
And they used to have discussions on the political situation of the time.
Yeah.
They used to discuss the hadith. And through this, she used to encourage people to go and fight for the movement of Imam Hussein. And according to history, two men ended up going to Kufa to support Imam Hussein. She was in Basra. Her house became a source of discussion on how to help the movement of Imam Hussein. And later we know that two men who used to pass through this house, who used to participate in these discussions or were part of these discussions, later went to Kufa to help the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Okay.
So these are the three women we can highlight who played an important role prior to the event itself. Karbala itself is a movement. You know, Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura says, I'm the one who has been killed because of Saqifa.
Okay.
Right? Karbala is something that it is the conclusion of an event that happened many years ago.
Yeah.
But it's a complete movement that teaches us to rise up against falsehood wherever you are. It doesn't matter what gender or race you are.
All right.
And therefore, these three women can be highlighted as having played a role prior to that battle itself.
Exactly. We'll talk more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the role of women prior to Karbala. You gave us examples of three women who provided extensive support to Imam Hussein al-Islam prior to his journey. So is there any more women you would like to add?
Actually, yes. It just came to mind right now.
Yeah.
There was a woman by the name Umm Wahab.
Okay.
Now, she has a role to play even in the battle itself. But prior to the battle itself, she lived with her husband in Kufa.
Yeah.
Her husband goes out and he sees an army being prepared.
Yeah.
To go to fight Imam Hussein. He goes back to his wife and he says, I want to go and fight in the army of Imam Hussein.
Yeah.
Because I believe fighting against these group who want to kill the son of the Prophet okay. is better than fighting the kafir, fighting the polytheists.
Okay.
So he says, I want to go. His wife encourages him. She's like, excellent, you've done the best thing you can do. Mm. Take me with you. I want to come with you.
Okay.
So she accompanies her husband, and according to some of the books, some of the historical traditions that we have, they reach on the 8th of Muharram. They live within the shadows of the nights.
Yeah.
Because the doors of Kufa were closed off for the people. People were not allowed to go to Imam Hussein at this time. So they somehow get out and they reach Karbala, according to some historical traditions, on the 8th of Muharram. Umm Wahab had a very important role. Now, we have different traditions of who she was. Two traditions I've read, but I'll only narrate one of what she did. On the day of Ashura itself, now she has a role prior to the battle itself and a role in the battle itself.
Okay.
In the battle, she takes a stick, runs out of the tent to fight Yazid's army.
All right, and she said, so there's an army who are with swords and who are with arrows, and there's a woman coming out of the tent with stick.
With a weapon. From what I've read, it's a stick.
Okay.
She kills two people over there.
Wow.
Imam Hussein prays for her. He says, but go back. Jihad is not wajib on women right now.
Yeah.
So he sends her back. But then her husband goes to the battle. Some traditions state that even her husband's mother was present.
Okay.
So he goes to the battle. Umm Wahab's husband goes to the battle. He fights. According to some traditions, he goes back to his mother. He tells her, are you pleased with me? She's like, I will never be pleased with you until you die in the path of Hussein.
Okay.
So he goes back to the battle. He dies. Now his wife, Umm Wahab, goes to the battle, sits at his head, wipes the blood of his head, and says, intercede with me when you meet the Prophet.
All right.
And Shimmer sees her over there. He sends his servant, Rustam, to go kill her. And she dies. She's the first female martyr from the battle itself. But she played a role before the battle itself.
And in the battle itself.
And she's killed in the battle as well.
All right. And she gets that status of martyrdom.
Exactly.
All right. So because she played a role prior to the moment of Karbala and in the Karbala itself. Well, you know, all this reminds me of some lines from Ziyarat Ashura, which says, may Allah's curse be upon the group who fought against Hussein and those who followed them and supported them and assisted them in killing him. But at the same time, if we reverse the line, may Allah's blessings be upon those who supported Hussein before Karbala, in Karbala, and post Karbala. And may Allah's blessings be upon these women, like as we say, فَشَوْعَتْ وَبَوْعَتْ وَتَوْبَعَتْ, who provided all the grounds before, in the journey or post-journey. Thank you so much, Sadiqa, for being with us. Inshallah, we'll continue the discussion in next session with you. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Muslim Lady. In case you have any questions, any suggestions for us, please write to us on englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The American people are still struggling with rising costs, and the situation isn't going to change anytime in the near future. We have prepared for you an article written by Gene Marks. The piece is titled US Inflation Isn't Going Away. Small businesses must plan ahead. According to a report recently issued by the U.S. National Federation of Independent Businesses, inflation is the top challenge facing small businesses this year, with a whopping 91% admitting that rising prices are having either a substantial or a moderate impact on their companies. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce says that nearly 7 in 10 small businesses have raised prices to cope with inflation, which is also considered their dominating challenge. 65% of small business respondents in a Goldman Sachs study said rising input costs have forced them to raise the price of their goods and services this year, with almost 80% saying the economy has gotten worse over the past 3 months. U.S. officials claim if Americans are having inflationary challenges in their business, they're not alone. However, they say there is some good news for them. And unfortunately, some bad news as well. The good news is that inflation appears to be plateauing. They claim prices for core materials such as industrial chemicals, construction supplies, copper, aluminium, plastics, packaging, iron and steel, and even agriculture products like fertilizer and processed feeds are either leveling off or not rising quickly. The price of lumber products has dropped significantly from their highs last year. Oil prices are down 30% from earlier this summer. But this is partly because the world's supply chain is beginning to show signs of normalcy. Port traffic in Long Beach, California is down to 84 ships off the coast, significantly less than during the pandemic. Mass lockdowns in China have ended, and the Baltic Dry Index, a key measure of freight costs and shipping demand, has fallen almost 30% since the beginning of the year. There's also been a general slowdown in the world's demand for goods, which, while not great, has certainly affected prices. It's doubtful whether the Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act, regardless of the positive impact it should have on our climate and healthcare problems, will have much impact on inflation. Penn's Wharton School says that the bill would actually increase inflation until 2024 and has low confidence that the legislation will have any impact on inflation. But officials claim the good news is that government spending has significantly decreased and the US Federal Reserve is no longer pouring fuel under fire. This brings me to the bad news. We're still struggling with rising costs, and the situation isn't going to change anytime in the near future. Producer prices, at 11.3% as of June, are still up well over historical levels. And because the Producer Price Index is considered a leading indicator, that means that ultimately consumer prices will remain at elevated levels for months to come. It took a year and a half for inflation to reach these levels. Consumer prices began rising in March 2021 and hit 7% by the end of 2021, well before Russia's special operation in Ukraine. It's going to take at least that long for it to return to the more sustainable levels we've seen in the past. It may take even longer. That's because there are lots of obstacles in the way of significantly taming inflation. Some economists, notably former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, believed the Federal Reserve's moves aren't aggressive enough. Further pressure from the Ukraine conflict could elevate energy and food prices, particularly as we head into the winter months. More COVID cases in China could once again disrupt the supply chain, even if the world economy begins to grow significantly again in the near future. That growth could put strains on US fragile supply chains and disrupt pricing for many of the core materials Americans buy. What is clear is that when and if prices do start to fall, it is going to take time, and in some sectors, a lot more time than in others. Nor is declining overall inflation a guarantee that prices will not rise in some areas again. The energy sector, particularly gasoline prices, have played a huge role in soaring inflation rates. Compared to last year, energy prices were up 41% in June, and gas price alone were up 60%. According to federal government statistics, Americans are using less gas this summer. Gas consumption in the United States is now over 1 million barrels a day, below levels that were seen in the summer of 2020, which was already lower than what was seen pre-pandemic. Despite falling demand, it is still unclear how long the low gas prices will last. The energy market is extremely volatile. Some analysts have warned that gas prices could go up again in the fall as stricter sanctions against Russian oil are set to start in December. The OPEC cartel of oil-producing nations agreed to an increase in oil output that is seemingly in a snub to Joe Biden, their smallest increase ever. Like the energy market, the food sector is highly volatile as well, as it is also sensitive to geopolitical relations and climate. The food index increased 10.9% over the last year, the largest 12-month increase since the period ending May of 1979. A number of factors went into the rising food prices, including a highly infectious avian flu that wiped out many chickens across the country. Tyson Foods, one of the largest meat producers in America, said that labor shortages and higher grain prices played a role in rising meat prices. The pandemic induced a shortage of semiconductor chips, which are used in everything from phones to television sets to cars, that is still being seen today. The shortage is squeezing the car industry. Analysts are predicting that the low number of new car sales, which dropped 12% year over year in July, will continue throughout to the end of summer as the supply of cars continues to be sparse. According to Cox Automotive, the average price for a new car hit a record $48,000 in June. In July, Americans were paying 10.4% more for new vehicles and 6.6% more for used cars compared with the year before. That's a dramatic fall from earlier this year. In January, used cars were 44.6% higher than they were at the start of 2021. But it still means prices are rising, and from a high base. Though the chip shortage does not affect the used car market directly, fewer new cars means that people are holding on to their cars rather than buying new ones. The Senate just passed a bipartisan bill that provides $52 billion in subsidies to chip manufacturers in the United States, an investment into developing a more robust domestic chip industry, though any impact from the bill on the car industry will not be seen for some time. Though used car prices showed signs of easing earlier in the summer, they still remain historically high and will probably remain so for the near future. Economists argue that it is possible that inflation has hit its peak, and there are signs that many of the pressure behind inflation are easing, but it is still hard to predict the path that inflation will take. Some of the prices being seen today, like for gas and homes, will probably continue to go down, but other costs will, in the best case scenario, stay put. The process of turning inflation is unpleasant. Fewer people can afford to buy houses or new cars, and businesses have less money to expand. But getting inflation down is necessary for the economy to get back to a healthy balance between supply and demand.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.